Welcome to another episode of Kitchen Sink. I think this is episode 9 now, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm recording this on Saturday, the 12th of September, and I'm recording on a Saturday because I think there's a plan being put in place that we go out for Sunday lunch tomorrow, so I thought I might get this one in the bag, at least the recording of it, and then I can tweak all my show notes and bits and pieces later on and hopefully get that out to you, and you should be listening to this hopefully on Sunday itself or during the week, maybe in or out of your commute to and from work. In any case, thank you very much for listening, and I have to say, this week just gone, which has flown by, I don't know where it went, but it was a very busy week, but a really enjoyable one. And I say that because, as I've mentioned before, I am currently working at the London Clinic in Harley Street, overseeing the operations there. That includes housekeeping, catering, and kitchen. And part of that is I want to understand that since we're feeding patients as well as our colleagues, I really, really want to understand what is the provenance of the food that we put onto the plate. And to understand that, I think the only way to do it is to actually go out, either get in a taxi, get on a tube, get on the train, whatever it takes, get in the car and get down and see those suppliers. So this week I've been very fortunate that I went to see one of our fish suppliers earlier on in the week, and then we, during the latter part of the week, on the Thursday, we went over to Smithfield Market and we saw one of our meat suppliers, which was quite an eye-opener in terms of how the market runs and so on. And that was quite a very, very, what's the word, a hustle and bustle. To see the hustle and bustle of the market and how it all worked was quite something. But for me, the highlight, I have to say, was on Friday morning, we headed over to Spitalfields. And I'd never been to the fruit market over in fruit and veg market over in Spitalfields. It was the first time that I'd been to see it, and I have to say that was a very, very enjoyable experience. We went to see it's a firm called Prescott Thomas, and there's a gentleman by the name of Peter Thomas, and I didn't realise that Peter Thomas featured in a BBC documentary last year, I think it was, about the markets. I wasn't aware of that. I've just had a quick peek on there on YouTube, and I'm going to share that link on the show notes, because I have to say I watched about 30 seconds of it, and I can't wait to watch the full episode, which is about an hour long. But I have to say Peter was a gentleman and super passionate about his topic of choice, which is, of course, fruit and vegetables. Been at it man and boy. Started with a barrow selling around various streets in London, and his father used to sell potatoes, and eventually went into business with his father and built the business up and got into some very prestigious hotels and restaurants in the West End and what have you, and eventually bought a company in, I think it was 1980 or something like that, he said, called Prescott's, that had been in business for over 100 years. So he kept the name Prescott's. He felt that was the right thing to do, and I agree with that philosophy. And showing some of the pictures on the wall, it was interesting to see, for example, one where it was one of the early delivery vans. And he said it was the first refrigerated delivery van in the UK. And what was quite amazing about that was where you had the outer shell of the back of the van. So you have the outer side that you would, paint your sign on the side of. And then you have the inner wall. And between that cavity, you would put blocks of ice. And that was it. That was the refrigerated van that would drive around and make the deliveries. And then as the day went on, the ice melted. And then you just unscrewed a little hole at the bottom and it drained out the water. So it just goes to show you how innovation can take some very, very subtle forms, shall we say. But what was really funny about that was within about 5 minutes of our conversation, I was reminded, because of the way he was and his character, I said, I've lost touch with a gentleman that I used to know many years ago. And I said, he used to sell fruit and veg wholesale over in Hayes and Harlington Market to the Barrow Boys. His name was Peter Cooper. And he said, hang on, Peter Cooper with the glasses? And I said, yeah. And he said, oh, I know Peter. Hang on a second. And he got his phone out. And he dialed the number and he said, "Is that Peter Cooper?" He said, "I've got a friend of yours here. Hang on, here he is." And I spoke to my friend Peter Cooper for the first time, as I said, in about 15 years, which was an absolute joy. So Peter said to me, "Thomas," he said, "I was thinking about you only a couple of weeks ago." He said, "I was on a bus, I think, on the Strand." He said, "We were going past a little pub called the Coal Hole, I think it is, near the Savoy." And he said, "Do you remember that lunch at the Savoy we had, and your father wanted to go in for a pint of bitter? He just needed a nice pint of bitter to round off his day, which was typical of my dad." And I have to say that lunch at the Savoy that Peter treated us to, my mum and dad and myself, and it was just before I set off to open my first restaurant in Kathmandu, Nepal. And a funny thing happened, and I must tell you this. I'm maybe going on a little bit about this, but this is a funny story that happened. So that particular lunch, let me jump forward. So we've opened the restaurant in Kathmandu, and we're into the winter time, and because of the winter time, we were limited in our seating. So it's a 300 seat restaurant, but we could only have tables inside, which at the time seated about 56 people. And this kind of very wealthy family came along, and they hadn't booked a table, but they'd heard about the restaurant, and we really struggled to give them a table. It was possibly, at that time, one of the worst experiences of my life as a restaurateur, because we were so busy and there were so many people queuing for tables, and we couldn't get them a table, and they were very, very well known in Nepal, and I was keen to get them a table. And they ended up leaving the restaurant without getting a table, and their father apologized or certainly let me off the hook a little bit by saying we perhaps should have booked a table. Anyway, as a result of that, the next morning I rearranged all the tables and I managed to get another 20 covers into the same area. And I stood back and I was admiring my handiwork, and I relayed to my team of Nepali waiters this story. I said, "I was taken out for a meal at the River Room in the Savoy Hotel by a friend of mine called Peter Cooper." And I was telling this to the waiters. And when we walked in, I said, and by the way, the reason I remember this is because the most coveted seats are the ones by the window. And we had just put a load of very romantic looking tables or two all along the window seats. So I said, "And when we walked in," I said, "Mr. Cooper," I said, "he shook hands with the restaurant manager, and I think there was maybe a £20 note in it, and he shook hands with him, and he said, 'Oh, Mr. Cooper,' he said, 'long time no see, come in, you know," and brought him over to the table, introduced him to the waiter that we were looking after us, and as we were being sat down because he really wanted a table by the window, again, another little note was handed across by way of thanking the waiter, and as he took the money and the handshake, he kindly said, "Here you are, Mr. Cooper, your usual table," and it was a very nice, you know, and we felt really good. Anyway, later that evening, in Kilroy's of Kathmandu restaurant, two Australian tourists walked in, very tall Australian tourists, backpacks and all the rest of it, walked in, they're looking around the restaurant, and straight away, one of my little waiters, Harry is his name, he's now working in a five-star hotel in Dubai, and he said, Namaste, sir, he said, "Long time no see." And of course, these gentlemen had never been in the restaurant in their lives, but he remembered the dialogue from what I was telling them earlier on. "Where would you like to sit?" he said. And of course, Kilroy's is quite a big restaurant, 300 seats, so there's about 60 tables to choose from. He said, "You can sit in the garden, or if you want to come up the stairs," and they were going up the stairs, "you can sit in the dining room, or you can sit in the bar or the bar terrace, or across on the terrace if you want." Anyway, eventually they chose their table, which, as you can imagine, first visit in the restaurant, as random as can be. And as he pulled out the chair for them to sit down, he said, "Ah," he said, "your usual table." And needless to say, he got a little bit of an extra tip that evening. So I have to say, it was wonderful to hear from Peter Cooper, and it was especially good to walk around Spitalfield Market and see what was going on there. In fact, I got a couple of bits to take home with me, and one was some beautiful Japanese aubergines, which my wife uses to make pakoras. And she basically slices them. And then what she'll do is she'll make a batter with a basic. It's called besan, is the product that you would buy in an Indian shop, but it's made from lentils, and it gives a very crispy batter. It's really nice. And also, I got some really good chilies, and I've got to tell you, because I'm a chili freak. I love chilies. And in my hand, I've got three punnets of chilies. One is the Naga Jalokia Ghost Chili, which I thought would be one of the hottest in the world. But I've actually got one hotter than that called the Trinidad Scorpion Ghost Chili. And also in my hand here, I have what is reputed to be the world's hottest chili. So I am led to believe, the Caroline Reaper Ghost Chili. So I have to say, I'm looking forward to sampling a little bit of those later on, possibly in a pickle that my wife is going to make with some tree tomatoes that I brought with me from that market as well. So some lovely ingredients that we got, a wonderful day out, as I said, meeting Peter Thomas over there in Spitalfield and to connect with an old friend. So that was my week at work, or part of my week at work. And during the week, some various stories have bubbled up, and I think we've got a bit of a packed show for you today. So let's see, where should we start? Heston Blumenthal has launched a new food and nutrition GCSE. So the Michelin-starred chef has teamed up with Exam Board OCR, which is part of the Cambridge Assessment Group, to help draft a new GCSE designed to get young people engaged in cooking. Which is a fantastic endeavour. Let me see. In line with the chef's own interest in molecular structures and culinary processes, the Food Preparation and Nutrition GCSE will seek to engage students in the science behind food, allowing them to understand effects such as how eggs create a stable emulsified sauce, such as a mayonnaise, and act as a raising agent, such as a meringue. So, you know, he's going to mess around with a little bit of liquid nitrogen and, you know, add in a few other bells and whistles in there. Will it be enough to get young people involved in cooking? I'm not so sure. Let's see. I mean, I wish Heston and the team there all the best with that. Although it does strike me, wouldn't it be fantastic if they had some kind of a food and nutrition and technology sort of related A-level that they could go on to? Oh yeah, that's right. They're abolishing it. And that's the point, isn't it? So on one hand, the government have come in and they've abolished, or they want to abolish, the A-level, which focuses on food technology. And meanwhile, one of the exam bodies has brought in, I'm sure at a reasonable expense, Michelin-starred chef Heston Blumenthal to put together a GCSE. Well, this is the problem, isn't it? It's just there's just not enough talking between the various departments and understanding what is it we're trying to do to attract young people into this sector. Let's see. What I would say to you is, again, I'll share this on the show notes, and I've shared it last week. Last week, we had up to 500 people who had signed the petition. It is currently looking at 1,900 people, just short of 2,000 people who signed the petition. Please go to the show notes, click on the link, and just put your name to the petition to see if we can reinstate or change the government's mind that they won't abolish the food tech A-level. I think that through initiatives such as the one by Heston Blumenthal putting a GCSE in place, such as the focus on apprenticeships, such as the fantastic work that is done by the Future Chef team in getting 8,500 young people into a cooking competition around the country every year, and through things such as, if we can keep it, you know, on the curriculum, this food tech A level, then there is a chance that we might just get young people into our sector, because it is just unsustainable. It's incredible that Britain's, as I've said in previous podcasts, the surveys have shown that Britons are spending a quarter of their annual income going out to eat, and that's continuing to rise. That's not going to fall, as far as I can see. And as a result, we need more young people to join our sector. So please, please click on the petition and put your name to it. It would be very much appreciated. Now, on the other side of the coin, of course, there is always the downside that we have to overcome. And I saw this headline that said, "No half-decent pub chef is paid enough. Ex-chefs on why they left the industry." And there's a couple of former chefs who have said, you know, that they were very unhappy in their roles, and that, you know, that even the term pub chef has the wrong connotation. For example, James Walker, who worked as a head chef at various pubs over 7 years, said, "The industry hasn't caught up with the real world. There is a little quality of life. The wages are always below what they should be. And a decent personal life or sustaining a decent relationship is hard, especially if you have kids. No decent pub chef is paid enough. Lots of things would need to change before I would go back as a chef. Wages are a big issue." And he just goes on to say, "The word pub makes people think of ping chefs." I guess he means microwave chefs. "But some of the best pubs in the country now have Michelin stars. It's not fair on all the chefs working 12 to 14 hours a day, 6 days a week." He makes one other point. "When I first became a chef, the respect shown to the chef was second to none. And that's how it should be. Nowadays, they're treated like crap. I'm not saying this should be on a pedestal, but some respect for years of hard graft and knowledge would be good. If you get a good head chef in your pub, then pay him what he wants within reason and treat him well. These are the guys that will make or break your business. It will cost more to have the right chef leave than it will to employ the cheaper one that is a yes man." So he makes a very, very interesting point there. What are your thoughts around this? If you have any thoughts, please share them in the comments section below this, the show notes of my podcast on thomaskilroy.com. Or why not join in the conversation over on Twitter, where you'll find me at My Kitchen Sink. That's sink as in synchronize. I think he makes a really good point. And again, another person who loves to, you know, have a pop every now and then at the government when things aren't looking so rosy. And that is, of course, Tim Martin of Wetherspoon. So the headline here in the Telegraph says, "Wetherspoon lashes out at government policies as profits slide." Tough trading has forced the pub giant to write down the value of its property portfolio as it launches a fresh attack on government's living wage. So again, that old chestnut, shall we say. Basically, pub's giant JD Wetherspoon has reported a £20 million slump in full-year profits as the falling value of underperforming pubs hits annual results. So in the 52 weeks to July 26, they climbed to 1.51 billion from 1.41 billion a year earlier, while pre-tax profits fell to 58.7 million from 78.4 million. So why was that? Well, actually, profits were hit by a £13 million charge that was largely due to the falling value of underperforming pubs in the property portfolio. Excluding this and other one-off costs, pre-tax profits before exceptional items was down 2% to 77.8 million. So actually, if they didn't have the write-down, it was just down 2%. But nevertheless, it doesn't stop them launching a fresh attack against the government's living wage, which, you know, Tim Martin has been a vocal critic. I don't know, it doesn't sit right with me. Here's a guy who has an expenses tab reported in one of his company returns of £26,000. I read somewhere else in another headline looking deeper at this that the cost of the JD Wetherspoon board is somewhere around £2 million. So, you know, I appreciate they are trying to mitigate their costs. I just feel that you know, blaming this living wage as we go into 2016, I don't think that's the right way about it. If there's a real problem there, Mr. Martin, I would suggest add another 3 or 4 pence onto your price of a pint of lager at the counter to mitigate those costs. Certainly, you know, the business model of JD Wetherspoon has been to pile it high and sell it cheap, to get those deals from the breweries where, you know, from what I understand, they would buy that up in bulk, get that round to their 900 odd pubs, and obviously they would be able to get it through before it goes out of date. And as a result of that, they've been able to undercut left, right and centre, and they have left many pubs that are locked into tight tenancies just floundering. Now, obviously they're not going to complain about that. To them, that's their business model. I would say, you know, if it's really such a problem, then why are we shafting young people on their minimum wage when we could maybe just add a few extra pence on the pint and maybe not shaft some of our competitors who are trying very hard to run a business model based on an outdated you know, brewery system that protects breweries and the beers that they produce. So yeah, I think there's a lot more going to be said about that. But certainly, I've just noticed that in the last few months, that Tim Martin certainly loves to have a good old moan about various things. And again, I saw that on Twitter this morning and just shared that with someone over at the Morning Advertiser. So anyway, let's see. Talking about undercutting rivals and piling high and selling cheap, Lidl, which has become a bit of a darling of the high street at the moment. Here's a very interesting headline, and I say interesting because it's not something you would see normally. I haven't seen it even in the catering press. It's in the marketing press. The headline says, and this is in The Drum, which is one of the main marketing magazines, Lidl strikes six-figure Mumsnet deal to accelerate plan to woo middle-class mums. So they have basically struck a deal with Mumsnet in a bid to further hone ongoing efforts to woo these middle-class mums. Bespoke branding from the supermarket on the parenting network will run alongside product promotions across Mumsnet's food content pages, forums and newsletters from today, which was on the 7th of September, over the next year. Videos from Mumsnet's vloggers will also champion the promotion, which will show how they have adapted to having their shopping at Lidl for a week. Of the partnership with Mumsnet, the supermarket's advertising marketing director, Arndt Pickard, said, and I'm quoting here, "We are the supermarket that is on mum's side, helping them to save huge sums with their weekly shop whilst bringing home quality food for their families. We hope that this new partnership will give even more families the tools they need to become smarter shoppers. We can't wait to get started." So again, I do find that a very, very intriguing headline. The fact that this website, Mumsnet, has managed to rise in prominence to such a degree that they can command a six-figure sum in sponsorship from a company like Lidl. So it just goes to show you. So let me have a look here. Was there anything else in that? Yeah, it's a move emblematic of the growing confidence Lidl is starting to emit through its marketing. The business, which along with Aldi continues to defy the sales slowdown its largest rivals currently face, and continues to spend big on its cheeky brand of advertising. The most recent ads from the store poke fun at FMCG suppliers. I think that stands for fast-moving consumer goods suppliers and rival supermarkets, by highlighting the perceived lack of difference in quality to its own brand products. According to Nielsen, for the 4 weeks ending 15th of August 2015, Lidl backed the campaign with a £3.7 million spend on TV and press advertising, a 261% increase from the same period last year. So that's a little bit of marketing news. Just to demonstrate that the idea that people are looking for a cheaper option, they've done very well. I think it's a very positive headline. They are willing to invest in the area where they believe that they have some growth value. Meanwhile, Tim Martin and his coterie of board members feel that maybe arguing against paying the lowest paid a bit more is the way forward to prop up their profits. That's one way of looking at it. Perhaps you have a different way of looking at it. I'm not so sure. So by all means, I'm happy to hear what you have to say. And if you have an opinion on that and you don't want to share that publicly, you can always send me an email on LinkedIn. You'll find me over on LinkedIn. And I'll be happy to share that without keep you anonymous if you want to do that. So let me have a look. Now, here was another little story, and I saw this through it was just a small tweet that came across. And when you click on the link, you see a story, and then that leads to another link, and you kind of go, "Oh, okay, that is interesting." So there is a really, really, really good blogger by the name of Kirsten Rogers. She also, she's known as Miss Marmite Lover. And basically, she says, when it comes to recipes, a little credit goes a long way. Because basically, she saw in 2014, a press headline announced the first ever Marmite cupcake. This came as a surprise, given that in 2010, Marmite had commissioned me to make 100 Marmite cupcakes, for which I created and baked two original recipes, which were also sent out to the press. I blogged the recipes at the time and also included one of them in my first book, Supper Club, Recipes and Notes from the Underground. And she goes on to say that, you know, okay, so let's start at the beginning. How do you know that your recipe has been plagiarized? This for me was the interesting question. And I always remember way back in the day when I used to be pastry chef to Anton Mosiman. Obviously, I was involved in some of the publication of his books in the background, prepping some ingredients for the photo shoots and what have you. And I always remember there was always that little copyright sign down at the bottom of the recipes, copyright of Anton Mosiman. And I thought, well, how would you know? But here, what's very intriguing to me is and thought-provoking more than anything, is the way that she has identified some key phrases that were used in the two different articles. So what she says is, so even more shockingly, the articles in the Daily Mail, Daily Express, Metro and Evening Standard mentioning the first ever cupcake made use of a press release from Marmite, where it quoted the managing director of this particular bakery, where it said, now this is the quote, "Marmite's saltiness complements the caramel extremely well, but the centre will either be a shock or a pleasure depending on where your Marmite sensibilities lie." And then what she then does is she then says, but compare this with my original 2010 blog post, which said, it was important to have that salty, intense Marmite hit peeking through the sweetness. And this was achieved by creating a strongly Marmite flavoured centre in the cupcakes. And then she says, this centre would either be a shock or a pleasure, depending on where your Marmite sensibilities lie. So there you go. Two perfectly aligned statements from two totally different sources. And she raises the point to say, I feel that was plagiarising my recipe, and I would like to be recognised for it. It's the first time I've seen that being highlighted. She tried to obviously take that up with the Craft Guild of legal food writers, shall we say, have a resident solicitor. But when she called for advice, they said they'd never heard of anybody winning in court in this country for recipe infringement. So I think that she, you know, obviously had to make a decision on that. But actually, what I'll do is I'll share that the link to that story. And also what she then did was to go on and share how to make your own Marmite. So the full recipe of how to make it and how she managed to get somebody from within Marmite to assist her in creating it. It's not quite the same, obviously. Marmite have a secret recipe to do it, but they gave her some pointers on it and she came up with quite a good version. I'm personally not a big fan of Marmite. Apparently it's a thing, you either love it or you hate it. I'm not a big fan of it. My wife loves it. But what I do find very interesting there is, regardless of love or hate of Marmite recipe, one thing I think that isn't right is that somebody would copy that and pass it off as their own. Now, last week I shared with you a link to a story. It was an essay written by Tim Sterk where he asked, and he was referring specifically to coffee, and he asked the question, what's in your cup? Well, this week, a little story, I say little, I think in certain niche markets, it's possibly a very major story, but certainly in the wider hospitality community, it's under the radar a little bit. And it's around tea. And basically what's happened is that, and I saw it as a result of a small headline here, and this is in, it was in the Caterer to say, tea brands vow to improve conditions after damning BBC Tea Estate report. So the first thing I did was to kind of go in and have a look at what was this this report. And basically, BBC News have gone in, done an investigation, which was by Justin Rowlett and Jane Deeth. And the headline says, "The Bitter Story Behind the UK's National Drink." And basically what they've said is, several of Britain's biggest tea brands, including PG Tips, Tetley's and Twinings, have said they will work to improve the tea estates they buy from in India after a BBC investigation found dangerous and degrading living and working conditions. Now, I have to say, I clicked on the story. There's a video there. It's about 4 minutes long. And yeah, you can see that there is some serious issues to be sorted out there. The joint investigation by Radio 4's File on 4 and BBC News in Assam, northeast India, found workers living in broken houses with terrible sanitation. Many families have no toilets and say they have no choice but to defecate amongst the tea bushes. You know, which doesn't say a lot for the tea, you would imagine, or maybe it's very good fertilizer, I'm not so sure. Living and working conditions are so bad and wages so low, according to this report, that tea workers and their families are left malnourished and vulnerable to fatal illnesses. There was also a disregard for health and safety, with workers spraying chemicals without protection, and on some estates, child labour being used. You know, and then it goes on. So I have to say, it was quite something. And the thing is, I'm very passionate about tea, and part of the reason for that is because having lived in Nepal, you know, Nepal has a very growing but very healthy tea market, shall we say. And as it happens, I married this girl, and when I met her brother, it turns out that he is Nepal's foremost, I would say, foremost tea expert, and his name is Bhushan Subba. And he is, you know, if you were to cut his arm, it would bleed tea. He is the most passionate person I've ever known about tea, and I have to say, I think I would even go further and say I think he's possibly the most knowledgeable person on the topic of tea on the planet. And that's a big statement to make. But the reason I say that is because he has, you know, worked with Winrock, where he has gone to various countries in Southeast Asia and advised those countries on their tea policies. He has stood in the farms, in the smallest of tea estates, in the most rural villages, with the tea farmers to help them with their tea and plant husbandry to get the best yield out of it. He has worked with the various tea producers of Nepal to help to bring together that market, if you like, and help to put their code of conduct in place, which he's very proud of. Now, with all that tea knowledge that Bhushan has, together with his wife Toots, they have set up a company called Tea Direct, where they do supply teas all over the world, especially over to America and into Germany. And they are trying to expand their UK market. They're going into a couple of very high-end specialist shops here in the UK. But what they did over just about last year was they opened a really, really chic tea room in Kathmandu. And what makes this tea room quite unique is that they really stripped away all the paraphernalia just to put the tea front and center of your experience. So the actual showroom itself is painted in four different colors, orange, black, white and green, and that's to signify that you have the orange pekoe tea leaves, you have black tea, which of course would be known as chai, for example, and then you have your white tea and obviously green tea. And anybody who visits, and they are attracting a very, very, you know, discerning customer into their shop in Kathmandu, you can try the most amazing teas that you've ever seen. And, you know, they have a full range of tea, but the teas that they specialize in are the organic, high-grown orthodox tea that is grown, you know, in the shadows of Kanchanjunga, shall we say, on the other side of the hills, away from Darjeeling. Now, what I've learned about tea from Bhushan over the years in our various conversations is, he said to me, you know, did you know that 90% of the tea that is sold, the Nepal tea that is sold, is bought by the Darjeeling producers to blend with their tea to bring up the quality? So, you know, Darjeeling tea is known as the champagne of teas, as a way of saying to you, look at the quality of our tea. But the first thing they have to do is they've got to run over the border and buy up as much of the Nepal tea as they can in order to bring it back, blend it with theirs and bring the quality up. So where we're very lucky here, myself and my wife, is that every now and then we get a packet or two packets of the most amazing leaf tea, usually a first flush orange pekoe, for example. And when you brew that and the leaves open right up, the full size of the leaves uncurl in front of you, and they're beautiful and still green coloured in the cup, and you get this beautiful rust coloured tea. It's just the most delicious thing. So I got in touch with my brother-in-law Bhushan just to find out what his thoughts were, and it turns out he had a look at the video, and believe it or not, the poor tea estate manager who's being interviewed in it, and he's really under the cosh because of this journalist asking these very difficult questions. He actually went to college with Bhushan, so Bhushan is very, very knowledgeable about the whole sector, if you like. And he came back to me and he said, yeah, it was bound to happen with the way things are done. And I remember many years ago he told me that the whole accreditation process around the, you know, whether it's Rainforest Alliance or Fair Trade or any of those, you know, the system is flawed, no matter what way you look at it. Now, without wanting to be too controversial about it, because obviously there's a lot of big players, they make a lot of money out of it. But one of the things that he said was, look, many of the tea farmers, certainly in Nepal, they're smallholders. You know, they at the end of the year, when they've paid all their bills, they might only have the equivalent of £80 left over as a profit. He said the margins are so small they can't afford to get the certification in order to get, you know, routes to market. So, for example, if Fair Trade wanted to come out to Nepal, he said to me, and this, as I said, is going on what I was told a number of years ago, he said, yeah, they would send out two inspectors who would want to travel, you know, business class, check them in at the Radisson Hotel for a week, eventually get them down, transport them to the tea estate. They will then do the inspection. And at the end of all of that, if they followed and done all the work, then they would get the certification to say it was fair trade or whatever the other auditing process would be. The problem is the cost of that, plus the actual fees for the annual certification, was so prohibitively high that it was only, ironically, the wealthiest farmers, the wealthiest producers that could afford it. So he said, you know, he always said to me that the process was flawed, and as a result, he himself, along with a few others within the tea community in Nepal, set up a self-regulated code of conduct, which you know, put in place some of the frameworks that would be in place had a certification come in. So, you know, very, very passionate about tea, selling the most amazing tea in the world. And then when I see that there are some abuses over in the Indian market, I think that it's slightly unfair that people such as some of those fantastic producers in Nepal aren't getting to the markets, and some of the others who are being supported are abusing their position. So let's see how that story plays out. I know that Yorkshire Tea have put out a very, very lengthy response to it to say that there is, they're basically looking into it. They are upset about it, needless to say. They're very concerned, and they have gone back to Rainforest Alliance. Rainforest Alliance have put out a statement, obviously to say that they're on it and they're looking into it. One of the sentences in here, it says in this statement by Rainforest Alliance, it says, and this piqued my interest, the auditing process in the certification system consists of annual programmed audits and, where necessary, unscheduled audits. When complaints are received, a research audit may be performed. This is an unscheduled inspection that corresponds to a complaint about a Rainforest Alliance certificate, farm or cooperative. Now, what's interesting about that? Well, what's interesting is that word unscheduled. Because if they have received a complaint, then they're going to have an unscheduled audit, which means that all the other audits must be scheduled. And I don't know about you, but if I know that in the next few weeks I'm going to have an audit and it's scheduled, and, you know, at the end of the day, we might have to pick someone up from an airport and it takes 2 or 3 hours to get them out to the tea estate. By then, maybe, you know, this is just a thought process. Go with me here. Maybe I'm not saying this is a fact. I'm saying that with human nature, that suddenly the people who are spraying the chemicals are wearing the PPE, that there is no sign of any, you know, anybody on that might be underage labour, etc., etc. I'm just saying it's possible that when you have scheduled audits, that they might not see the whole story. So hopefully, as a result of some of these unscheduled inspections, that they might pick up on some of the things that were featured in the BBC programme. The other thing, of course, is the Rainforest Alliance certified, and they have to stick in that little TM there to make sure that the trademark is assured. So let me see. That was a little story around tea, a very negative aspect around tea. So let's see what comes of that, and hopefully improve the lot of those poor people over in those tea estates who work so hard to bring us our builder's brew. In terms of future gazing, three little stories popped up over the last few weeks, and I have to say they're all, you know, they say interesting things. I think it's always a risk when you talk about the future, future trends or anything that's happening. But Hospitality and Catering News ran with a story which is entitled, so basically it's a latest trend report from J. Walter Thompson, which says the future of food and drink. Now, I have to be honest with you, I've read through this. So the Innovation Group, the Innovation and Futurism Unit of J. Walter Thompson Intelligence, reveals the future of food and drink in its latest trend report. As the pace of innovation in food and drink accelerates, driven by digital media, advances in technology and a newly politicized awareness of food among consumers, the report offers a snapshot of today's innovations and what they reveal about the food and drink consumers of the future. Now, Lucy Green, who is Worldwide Director of the Innovation Group, she says, our research shows that both US and UK consumers are placing increasing importance on food and drink as an experiential luxury and reflection of their personal identity. We also found that millennials, despite their well-documented economic challenges, are demanding higher quality food, visual stimulation and technologically enhanced experiences. Now, as I said, I've read this, and you can click on the link in the show notes. I'll share it in the show notes. But there's a number of various statements that are made as a result of the, you know, the data highlights these things. But I'm just wondering, are they not just kind of obvious? For example, 74% of US millennials and 58% of UK millennials believe that marijuana will become as socially acceptable as alcohol over the next decade. Okay, so that statement most likely is a factual statement. They believe that marijuana will become as... But haven't they been saying that since before Nixon was forced to resign, you know, around the time of the protests for the Vietnam War, that, you know, we should all chill out and kick back and enjoy life. I think that's going to continue. Any young generation of people that are asked a question about marijuana, they're going to say, yeah, this is the next big thing. And they'll keep saying it. And then they'll have kids. And then those kids will be saying it. That's my belief. It goes on to say, foodie culture has gone mainstream as it becomes an increasingly important part of personal identity. So here's another statement. 4 out of 5 US millennials say that they consider going out to eat to be a cultural experience. Well, again, it's a factual statement because 4 out of 5 is it. I would argue that the other 20% just don't know what a cultural experience is, because anyone who goes out for a meal is most likely having a cultural experience. I mean, even my own 14-year-old daughter, who goes up the street this morning to have a McDonald's McMuffin for breakfast, because that's the thing that her group of friends are doing right now. They feel that that's a trendy and hip thing to do, and they go up and they have that breakfast because it's part of that cultural experience that they are going through right now of growing up. And in time, that'll change to be something else, and it'll change to be something else again. And at each stage, it's I would argue, a cultural experience. Another statement here says, ethnically minded consumers want ethnically minded brands. 93% of US millennials and 79% of UK millennials would support food brands that help society become healthier. Again, I have to agree with that. But as we've seen, as long as they don't have to pay too much for it, possibly. But certainly when they're being asked the question for a survey, then they say it because that's what they believe. Like I said, a lot of that stuff in there was quite, I don't know, I have to take it as a pinch of salt, I would say, for want of a better phrase. One interesting one that did strike me, and it made me laugh, fat is back. So this was one that said, discourse around fat is changing. Far from being off the menu, it's back and is being positively encouraged by brands and chefs in new products and ingredients. And the reason I'm smiling about that is because I do remember my old pastry lecturer, John Hubert, who never, ever, ever substituted any of his recipes with nothing other than butter. It had to be butter, cream, you know, and so on and so forth. Over the years, I've kind of said to myself, I wonder if there's some truth in it. And the reason I'm smiling is because I do remember that in 1973, there was a film made called Sleeper. And I remember watching it, you know, because in 1973, I was only 2 years old. But I remember watching this, and it was a Woody Allen film where he wakes up 200 years in the future in a medical facility. And they had this kind of dialogue around the idea that he wanted healthy food. And they were laughing at the idea of healthy food because they have now realized 200 years in the future that unhealthy food is actually good for you. So I'm just going to play literally 30 seconds of this movie just for you to hear this dialogue, because I think it's just quite incredibly prescient, shall we say, of Woody Allen to put that in 1973. Here we go.
Does he ask for anything special?
Yes, this morning for breakfast, he requested something called wheat germ, organic honey, and tiger's milk.
Oh, yes, those are the charmed substances that some years ago were felt to contain life-preserving properties.
You mean there was no deep fat? No steak or cream pies or hot fudge?
Those were thought to be unhealthy. Precisely the opposite of what we now know to be true.
Incredible.
So there you go. You know, it just makes me smile that here we are in 2015 talking about fat being back on the menu as encouraged by brands and chefs in new products and ingredients. In other sort of future gazing, there was, well, a little article that I was going to share called Waste Not, Want Not. And within that, it said 2015's what's hot culinary forecast. And this particular report comes out of America. It's a PDF that it links to. And it basically gives this enormous array of different food trends that are, you know, so for example, the top 20 food trends, and number one is locally sourced meats and seafood, locally grown produce, environmental sustainability, healthful kids meals, and number five, coming in at number five, natural ingredients or minimally processed food. To be honest, I think the future is here. You know, if these are the food trends at the moment, then I would say that we've had them for quite some time, because locally sourced meats, or perhaps maybe what I'm saying is that in the UK, locally sourced meats and seafood, locally grown produce, all of that stuff has been a feature of menus over the last 3, 4 years, 5 years, you know, where right down to the name of the farm, the name of the farmer, the name of the field that it was grown in. it's been highlighted on the menu, and maybe only now it's showing up in the American trends. But that was a little survey put out by or done by the National Restaurant Association together with members of the American Culinary Federation. I think for me, just scrolling down, what was the least? So coming in the lowest, let me have a look here. I'm just scrolling down. The last five are deviled eggs, fried chicken, frying, chicken wings, and coming in last is gazpacho. I don't know what that tells us, you know, but I just think that if you're going to look at the top trend, then let's have a look at what's coming in last. And frying is coming in last. And when you look at what's happening around street food, I wonder, is that strictly true? I don't know. Have a look at it yourself, see what you think, and we can always pick it up on Twitter. And one other headline that I saw in the New York Times, which was Restaurant of the Future. It asked the question, you know, is this the restaurant of the future? Service with an impersonal touch. The opening couple of lines are quite funny. It says, there's a new quinoa restaurant in San Francisco. Yes, quinoa restaurants are a thing in San Francisco. So that's not what's noteworthy. At this restaurant, customers order, pay and receive their food and never interact with a person. And it goes on to say that the restaurant Ita is the first outlet in a company with national ambitions and is almost fully automated. There are no waiters or even an order taker behind the counter. There is no counter. There are unseen people helping to prepare the food, but there are plans to fully automate that process too if it can be done less expensively than employing people. For optimists, it's a way to make restaurant going more efficient and less expensive. For pessimists, it's the latest example of how machines are stealing people's jobs. Either way, it's like heaven for misanthropes or those who are in too much of a hurry to chat with the server. Well, I know one person who would absolutely love to put that in place, and that is Tim Martin over at Wetherspoons, because then he wouldn't have to be paying out that minimum wage that he absolutely hates the idea of going up. So there's three stories on the future of food. Do you agree with them? Do you not agree with them? By all means, if you want to share some of your thoughts and opinions on that, in the comments section below this podcast on thomaskilroy.com or over on Twitter, you can find me at My Kitchen Sink, as in synchronize. So basically, that's a lot of the news that we've been looking at this week. Let me have a look if there's anything else. In terms of restaurants, I have to tell you, I haven't been out to anything spectacular this week. Although I have to say two things I have enjoyed. When I was at Smithfield, I went to a little restaurant. Now, it was next door to a very good restaurant. I must mention Bird of Smithfield, a really, really top class restaurant. I have not been there, but I have heard wonderful things. And I know that that the very, very, very well respected chef, is it Alan Bird? I think it is. And his brother, Neil Bird, worked, was a colleague of mine at Baxter Story. But the restaurant I went to was just next door, a place called Smith's of Smithfield. Very vibrant. And I had a full English breakfast, you know, at 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock in the morning. And it was a really proper breakfast. If you want to have a little experience of what London life is like, then I would suggest then why not go down to you know, Smithfield Market dead early and have a walk around and have a wander and see what's going on and maybe enjoy a bit of breakfast down there. And then over in Spitalfield, again, I have to say it's on a Saturday morning or on a Sunday morning. My understanding is that it's open to the public. You can go in and buy your fruit and veg there. And I had a full English breakfast there, which was super good. So I've eaten a little bit too much of the old bacon, egg and sausage this week. So I need to go out for a run shortly and work some of that off. But highly recommended experiences if you want to understand what's going on with your food in your hospitality operation. In terms of a management tip, I always try and think of something that you can try and apply in your sort of you know, in your workflow, back in your office or whatever. If you work with teams, whether it's people who report into you or whether you work with a team of colleagues on something new, then very often you might have to come together and brainstorm an idea. You might have to kind of, you know, or for example, you want to go around a room and everybody puts a little bit of input. The problem with that, of course, is the minute you say, right, well, let's start on the left and we go around from left to right or whatever, then each person then is waiting and expecting for them to speak. They know that they're fourth or fifth in the row. So a way to avoid that and to keep it, you know, keep everyone on their toes, for example, is if you get everyone to stand in a circle, and then maybe with you know, an orange or you know, it could be a little rubber ball or something, and then basically one person starts and says an idea or says what are they working on currently or where are they on the A, you know, on a particular project, and they say their piece and then they throw the ball or the orange or whatever it is across to another person in the group, and that person catches it and then they have to say you know, either their contribution to the idea brainstorming session or to update the group on where they are and so on and so forth. My brother, who is a coder, used to work for a consultancy firm, and the way that they used to update each other on where they stood with their given projects was to do that every morning. It took about 3 minutes, and it just meant that everybody just understood exactly who's where, who's doing what, and then they went off about their day. And I just thought it was a very, very good way of being able to it's a bit of fun, keeps people on their toes, and certainly the minute you sit down and you have this kind of long, drawn-out meeting, it just adds a bit of lethargy into it. So there's a little management tip for you. I'm trying to keep it brief because I realize I've possibly waffled on a bit today, so I hope that there was something in there for you. Whether it was to do with tea or to do with training or whether it was to do with minimum wage or the future of our industry in terms of food trends. This has been Kitchen Sink. I'm Thomas Kilroy. Until the next time, whatever you do, make it productive and fulfilling. Thank you for listening.